here's the thing. There won't be a gay gene. If the data we have already is for real, and, you know, one can always discover that there's a problem at the level of the data that you're not in a position to know. But assuming that the data is what we think it is, there won't be a gay gene. Can there be gay genetic influences? Sure. That could be. There are patterns that are simply inconsistent with a gay gene. And right. What's more, I don't think the questions are insurmountable as to whether or not a gay gene could propagate evolutionarily, but it's not a simple question of how they would. But in any case, to build the protection of homosexuals on the idea that there is simply no environmental influence, and therefore, as you argue in the book, that effectively it would be immoral to hold people responsible for something over which they had no control, that's not a sound foundation. Now, it may be that people have very little choice, especially here we're going to step on a big landmine, okay? Or I am.
You go first.
Okay. At least for males, there is likely to be not very much choice because the switch will have been flipped very early.
Right.
So in any case, we don't need a gay gene in order to fully support the argument for compassion and understanding. But it was a useful crutch before we had enough information to know what was going on, and people are understandably reluctant to give it up.
By the way, the landmine you just deftly tripped over, it was one of the ones that fascinates me, because I say to everyone who complains about what I'm saying about the gay bit, that when I say, look, maybe it's a bit more mellifluous even after a certain stage than we pretend, and that a gay isn't necessarily, as I say, a one-way street. Even the people who object to that deeply, concede I might be onto something in the case of female lesbianism.
Right. Well,
because there's definitely more adaptability there than there is among male homosexuals. But there are some lesbians who have had horrible experiences with men, or have had a terrible husband, or worse, and they end up falling in love with a woman. I do not know of any case with a man who's married to the most horrible woman and as a result starts to screw around with men.
As a straight guy, it's hard for me to imagine a woman that horrible, but
that's right. I'm leaving you. I'm going to go to the local gay bar as a result.
Yep. But I mean, if you think about it, look, the reason that this should be more flexible on the lesbian side is staring us in the face. It's just obvious. As you said, it's not that hard. Gay men have a really, and you know, again, among the many amazing points that you make in this book that I've never heard anybody else say, but you know, we're begging for an exploration. Gay men have a problem producing babies. The mythology of the moment may be that they don't, but you know, Monty Python correctly nailed the fact that a pair of men don't have a uterus, you know, and therefore that invites questions about how it's going to be done. Women don't have this problem. In fact, a lesbian couple has a couple of uteruses, right? What that means is that there is an opportunity. Here, let's just do this straightforwardly in an evolutionary sense. Human babies are extremely expensive to raise, and they are much better raised when people team up, right? So a straight partnership is a team, and its primary objective is the successful raising of babies, the production of resources, the nurturing, the delivery of information on how to be a successful human. A single individual has a problem raising a baby. There's just not enough labor. It's too labor intensive. A pair of lesbians has the labor and the uteruses. What they lack is a single cell, right? All they need is a single cell to trigger a baby, and then everything else they've got, right? Now, there are plenty of ways that history can deliver a circumstance in which there aren't enough men around. For example, warfare. Warfare will eliminate men from the map. Are we really to imagine that evolution will take a bunch of people who are perfectly capable of raising offspring and sideline them from that most fundamentally Darwinian objective because there aren't enough men around for people to pair off? Oh no, that's not how it's going to work. Surely, people who have everything necessary to produce offspring of their own will team up and do so, especially if all they need in order to trigger the process is a single cell. They'll find one. Right? And so the point is, lesbian couples make perfect evolutionary sense in many circumstances. And that would mean that the ability to facultatively go in that direction at the point that it becomes a viable path forward should be there as a contingency plan built into women. We can't make the same argument for men. At some point, I will make an argument for the evolutionary nature of male homosexuality, but I'm not ready to deploy it in public just yet.
I have to say, I do want you to do that, Brad.
All right. Well,
because as you know, I lay down that challenge slightly in the book. I say, look, the evolutionary biologists have been ducking this one for a long time now.
Yes, ducking. Notice there's plenty of room under the table here for me to duck if I must. All right. So where were we? We were talking about the understandable desire amongst people who feel that they have something personal at stake to avoid certain kinds of exploration. And then others of us find those explorations are necessary, even to the very protection at the focus of that concern, right? I would say gay people are far safer if we explore this carefully than if we pretend the issue is simpler than it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I give the example of why gay activists who want the gay gene to be discovered should be careful of what they wish for, because even if they did suddenly, rather unlikely though both you and I think it is, even if they did find such a gay gene, what people would do about that, we've already had a couple of little glimpses of it. I give the example that Alice Drager gives in Galileo's Middle Finger of the unbelievable stampede that occurred when one scientist was rumored to have found a gay gene in sheep, and as a result was experimenting on sheep, and the gay rights groups were got up by PETA, I think, the animal ethics of people, and they whipped up the animal people whipped up the gay people to go for the guy who allegedly found the gay sheep, and he hadn't, but they were so enraged that this man might have done and might be doing something terrible with it that might, for instance, be taking homosexuality out of the sheep pool. And so we're clearly not going to be any good with dealing with this if it was what they wanted either. And that's sort of, by the way, I should say, that's sort of why I started with the chapter on gay, because I wanted to demonstrate, in a way, the sort of subliminal thing was I wanted to demonstrate to readers that I could do this with the one minority interest group that I've got any alleged involvement in, to say, well, not alleged, but to have any involvement in, to say, look, and then we should also be able to do that on these other issues. So it shouldn't be this hard for men and women to talk about each other, specifically for men to talk about women. And we're making it much harder than it should be. And, I sort of hoped that comes across. That's why I've done it that way, let alone then I get onto race and trans. But just to say, look, this is a different manner of approaching these things we have to try to find, and it has to take our purported characteristics. We have to lean on them less.
I think what you do in the book with gay, actually, I think the book would stand without it, frankly. I think it's good enough. But I think the fact of watching you explore this in a place where you do have a dog in the fight, is exactly the necessary thing to demonstrate that the bad faith isn't there. So in other words, this is again why I say the defense against your book has to involve people not reading it, right? Because watching you do this in a place where obviously you have a great deal at stake in how society views gay men, And, you know, doing it in a way, frankly, that as I was a little surprised as a straight man that you dealt so carefully and effectively and insightfully with the way a straight man views male homosexuality, which is
right.
I am perfectly accepting. I believe it that male homosexuals are deserving of protection, but there is a way that I find the idea of being a gay man a bit distant. I can't relate to it very easily. Now
that's why I say there is something that's problematic, to use one of the terms of the era. I mean, I noticed it a long time ago because there is a certain type of woman who, for instance, with gay men, wants to talk dirty. Like, they want to talk sex with you. And equally, there's a type of straight man who has a lot of questions. and not even just about what it's like to have sex with a guy, but questions about sex in general. Yep. Like with the female thing. And what I realized was this was a long time ago this came to me, that both parties thought that gay men were some kind of translation device.
Yes.
They're not entirely wrong. Right. And that's why, and you see, one of the things that I find fascinating about this is that actually, if you open up the gay bit a bit, you also get to some of the truths about male-female relations.
I loved that exploration. I thought you slam dunked it.
Well, that's very kind. That bit with the women chapter was in some ways the most fun bit to write because I knew that, you know, I think I've said before, but all the problems in this book, I sort of boil down to the fact that we're pretending to know about things we don't know about, trans, and we're pretending not to know about things everyone knew till yesterday, relations between the sexes. And that although it's complex, it's not as complex as we've been pretending it is. But, you know, some of the things of recent years, I did feel, for instance, in the post-Me Too period, that there was something that gay male relations illuminated on the truth of what we weren't able to talk about in the whole male-female, when are men taking advantage of women question, which was to return the question and say, are there occasions when women are taking advantage of men? And because you can do exactly that play in the gay world, you can, I sort of carefully lay it out, but everybody knows the situation in which if you want to reduce relationships to power dynamics, that the person who the sort of intersectionalists would regard as being the powerless figure in a particular dance is actually the one commanding the whole dance. And that the person who society claims to be the person with unbelievable amount of power is a pathetic, vulnerable, manipulatable person in the wrong or right hands.
Yeah, it's a marvelous description. It matches perfectly what I've seen so many times now, including at Evergreen, very personally, where this naked exercise of power is described as basically a cry of powerless people that is and always will be unheeded or something like that. And it's you know, it is one of a thousand ironies in this area. But you demonstrate exactly the thing that I saw in that seminar, which is the ability to take yourself, not to pretend that your particular way of being in the world isn't who you are, but putting it aside with respect to what you conclude, right? You do a very good job of that in the gay chapter, and then it does allow you to explore to use the same analytical tools with respect to race, with respect to trans, which is in some sense the hardest of these. My guess is that's why you left it till last in the book. And then, you know, trans kids being the sort of gold standard of really heart-wrenching, difficult issues. But, you know, I said something to Chloe Valdery the other day. I had a discussion with her, and I said, you know, the irony at Evergreen was that we were watching the breakdown of a college and it was breaking down over the beliefs of a group of people who, more than anything else, desperately needed a good college education. And, you know, I can't quite make it, I can't put flesh on the bones enough, but imagine standing in a college watching a microcosm of civilization break down when every tool that you should need to solve the issue was like right there, rendered in, you know, concrete and steel, right? We had the buildings, we had the library, in theory, we had a faculty. Why don't we just take the perspective that is being advanced and take it as a premise, put it on the board, and then explore, if we extrapolate from this, where does it actually lead? And I have the sense that your book is in, it is like, I don't want to say it's a textbook, that's not fair to it, but it is like the curriculum for such a discussion. That
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so. I'd like it if it became so, but I'm terribly conscious of what we're throwing out. I mean, as you know, I write about the Evergreen thing in a couple of pages in the book, because it did seem to me to be one of the most emblematic examples of this breakdown of our day. And one of the things that fascinates me again in this is that people who wish to read the world in these rather ugly power dynamic terms keep missing out the fact that, again, in that sort of situation, the power is exactly the opposite way around. The students have the power, the authorities have none. And there's all sorts of fascinating things that one can trace that to, I think, and you experience it firsthand. But there's an awful lot of cases of some of the madnesses I write about in the book where something similar is happening, where the grown-ups appear to have, in significant chunks, lost faith in the process that had got them where they had got to. And they had decided at some level to hand over the keys to the kids. And the thing that's so disturbing about that is not just the loss of knowledge, the loss of opportunity. I mean, unbelievable loss of opportunity for those students and others, but that anybody who's been through an education knows that there are always times when you wonder if you could do that and if you could pull that move. I remember it very distinctly from my student days. If I try to use an insincere tool, will it get me through? And the job partly of education, or not just education, being made into a citizen and a person in the world, is the adults turn around to you at that point and say, Sonny, there is no way around this. You have to go through it. You have to just do what you need to do. You need to do the work, and there's no cheap way through. And I'm just amazed that in subject after subject and discipline after discipline and institution after institution, the implication is given and sometimes stated boldly, there are other ways around this. For instance, you don't actually need to do the work. You could pull an insincere card on a person in a more senior position, and that'll get you to the same place.
Right. And the jaw-dropping conclusion from this is that these students are learning, but this is what they are learning, is how to get by through this mechanism. They are becoming expert at it. And the question is, what world will we live in as these tools are refined? They're going to be wielded by people in ever more powerful positions. And I think this is one of the harder points to make. Lots of people say, well, yes, okay, the Evergreen thing was very dramatic, Yale, this, that. But it's a small number of people. You're exaggerating. I hear it all the time. I think it's hard to compel people it's like, well, okay, smallpox is terrible, but, you know, the release was only a few cells. It's only in one part of the country. And it's like, no, it's smallpox. Do you realize how dangerous this is, right? So yes, it's a small number of people wielding a tremendous amount of power, learning to wield it better, teaching others to do it, distributing the toolkit through the internet. This could hardly be more dangerous.
Yeah, and I mean, and the though I just read this week about the case of the Seattle school board's maths teaching curriculum, where they decide to do identity politics stuff in maths, and you just go, you know, for those of us who were educated in the humanities, you know, our only hope always is that at least there are still some hard sciences around, and this crap isn't going to roll through that. And whenever you see it rolling through that, and you realize that the mathematics is going to be, you know, how is power-to-power structures rely on blah, 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 that you think, you know, if you do that, the bridges are going to fall down at some point, you know, just nothing is going to be able to stand up. And that's sort of the bit that's one of the bits that worries me. But by the way, I just wanted to say one way through this, or at least one way I've started to think about this is how about we try to work out like the unpleasant questions which everybody knows are legitimate. I gave you one earlier about the male female thing. You know the obvious thing is there forms of female power that men don't have. But there's one that struck me in recent days, which is, well, just to let me line up, because the point I'm going to make is going to be a problem. But if I don't give one more caveat,
go for it.
In the book, as you know, I raise the issue of what could be regarded as gay privilege, which is that studies show that across their earning life, male and female homosexuals are going to earn disproportionately more in their career than their heterosexual counterparts. And there's a number of very interesting reasons why that might be, from the rather mundane, well, you know, they don't have children so much, so they can stay in the office later and thus get promotions and so on, to more psychological explanations to do with mimetic issues in childhood and much more. But you might call this a gay advantage. And if you were interested, and one of the things, obviously, as you know, that the book's trying to do is to say, look, this stuff is not just in the humanities and it's not just in the social sciences departments. It has spilled out across the entire working environment of corporate America, Britain, and other developed Western economies, and that it's a deranging game because it's an unwinnable game. But I say, okay, if you're going to do that game, is this gay privilege? And if you're trying to even things out, which is what this purports to do, why don't we look at taking some of the money from the gays and giving it to their heterosexual counterparts?
Because hell yeah,
it seems unfair. Sorry.
That wasn't a proposal.
I knew I'd get you. And that's why I'm writing a check this evening to Mr. Brett. No. But it's reparations.
Yep.
For your suffering for being heterosexual.
Right.
But for your untold suffering. But the point I wanted to make then was, okay, so there's loads of advantages that we know are there. And I mean, one of the nice things about, you know, people now reading this book is the number of people who've written to me who I know, and strangers who say, you know, said things like, oh my God, this is a conversation my wife and I have over dinner. And, you know, somebody said to me, this is a conversation my wife and I have over dinner. And my wife said to me, I'm like, darling, never say this outside of this room. You know, I like those sort of ones. It's like, you know, anyhow, but there must be forms of piss taking, we'd call it in the UK, but let's say just advantage taking, to sort of de-load the language a bit. There must be lots of advantages that do exist in society and which we pretend don't. Here is one which is just so alarming, and I'm bound to get in trouble even just for voicing it, but like, are there on occasions, and this isn't to deny the history of racism, this is not to deny that there are inequalities, including racial inequalities and racial injustice that goes on today in America and around the world, but are there situations where there is an advantage to being black? Are there situations where there is an advantage to being a woman or being gay or being trans? And you go, yes. Yes, there is, definitely. I had one incidentally the other day in a television studio. It's not exactly the worst oppression anyone's suffered, but I had a female black model, former model, discussing some of the issues in my new book with me. She was very nice, and she just wouldn't stop talking. And it's possibly because she was brought up in Scotland, in Glasgow, and they just don't shut up in Glasgow. And but the reason I mention this is because she just wouldn't stop. And she was, and I knew at the moment I saw her, she was uninterruptible, absolutely uninterruptible. And she knew it. And she knew it. And she did as much. She said, the host, Piers Morgan, actually at one point said, I just want to get Douglas in because he hasn't had a chance to speak. And I sort of said, oh, well, you know, and I tried to come in. And she said, no, I think he's spoken a lot, actually. I've had to listen to him already. And I just thought, okay, I can't do anything about this. In this studio this morning, you have got a black advantage. And you've got a female advantage already. And the reason I mention this is because I think that a lot of people know this stuff. I think she knew. And I definitely knew, and I know that the hosts knew. And there's a lot of those things going around in the society. And we don't have any of it out ever, because we have all fallen for the social justice interpretation, which says there's only one type of power, and it's elderly, white, heterosexual, cis-normative power. And it means that there are these very... I mean, the example I give of my television experience is a very minor one and unimportant, but there are major weaponizations of this power happening at major institutions all the time, which everybody can see and no one can identify.
Beautiful. Now, I want to take your last two points because I think it gets even more dire if we extrapolate. No doubt you will have seen this coming, but... All right, so you've got these ideas that create a kind of power, an unacknowledged sort of power that schedules what can be said and who can say it and, you know, who gets to take up space in a conversation or something like that. And you have these ideas that become unexplorable, right? So we can study genetics, but it becomes difficult to study genetics anywhere around race or gender or sexual orientation. And as you say, the bridges will fall down. Well, they will, but something worse will happen also. You have a competition between those who can figure out how not to succumb to this nonsense and those who can't. And those who can figure out how not to have their engineering school deranged by these ideas will have a superior engineering school. Their bridges will be much less likely to fall down. And so what I am concerned about as an evolutionist is that what we are producing is a recipe where those people who find no reason to engage the question of oppression come out on top, because those who are obsessed with oppression will self-hobble. And so I don't want to live in the world on the other end of that, where the people who may suffer from a total compassion deficit come out on top because they figured out a way to shut this stuff down, maybe for the wrong reasons even.
I don't want to, what I'm about to say also could be misinterpreted, but look, I mean, there's a chance that even if the intersectionalists and the identity politics people got what they wanted, the likelihood, I mean, I think that they can't ever get what they wanted for reasons I demonstrate, that it all runs against each other. It's a horrible, great big bloody mess that kind of just keep making, you know, my favorite Orwell quote, when he once spoke to a communist in the 40s, and, you know, Orwell says to this communist, you know, well, you know, what have you got to show for this wretched stuff? And the communist says, well, you know, he admits the show trials, he admits the famine and so on. And Orwell says, you know, what's the point of that? And the communist says, you know, well, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And Orwell says, well, where's your omelette? And you know, there is a sort of, even if the intersectionists got what they wanted, it would be horrible. But if they did, if they ever actually managed to create the exact perfect system which allowed everyone to work out their place in the hierarchy all the time, and the working place in corporate America was exactly along the lines of what they wanted, they'd do it just in time for China.
Right. It won't hold truck there, and so suddenly they will be opening the door to a competition from... they will be opening the door to a superior competitor that just simply won't be playing this game.
Yeah, yeah, and I've very little doubt that that's what happens. And by the way, there's a sort of more mundane but more painful day-to-day thing that I notice, which is I mean, we hear a lot of talk about, you know, disenfranchisement and much more. And but and let me give you one example of that, is that it seems to me that emerging is that slightly more privileged, if you wanted to play that game, slightly more privileged, say, young white men are able to work out the game and are able to adapt, play around it, do the stupid stuff everyone's got to do to perform it, but actually get what they want. And the problem is that less advantaged, including less intellectually advantaged, less economically advantaged people, are going to get stuck in the game. I mean, I see this all the time with the cuttlefish analogy I give. I know exactly the type of rich Western man who has worked out how to feminize themselves sufficiently around women to get to shag the women. And I know exactly the type of man who is failing at that because they just haven't worked out the game.
Yep.
And I think there's just, it's a horrible, horrible thing. I don't think that'd be secret knowledge.
Secret knowledge, right? And again, it goes to your point about whether gay men know something both straight men and straight women are fascinated by and need to know something about. I should tell you that cuttlefish analogy, is a fascinating one. It is not the only version of this. It's actually a strategy that evolves many times across the animal kingdom, right? It's called a she-male strategy. Maybe it's not called that anymore. Because it's
very offensive to Bangkok ladyboys.
Right. But anyway, the evolutionary dynamics around it are fascinating, but you're right. What we've effectively created is a niche for people who can figure out how to game the system in a particular way. And anytime you set up a system that can be gamed and won by those who do it, that's what you're going to see. And so we are creating a very dangerous environment in which even those who are well-intentioned in setting this up do not understand that, okay, you may advance the interests of black people, for example, but which black people are going to end up at advantage in the end of this game? It's going to be the bad actors in that group, not the people who are most deserving. So anyway, we are in a terrible pickle in this regard. And the question, I guess, I feel like we are in an arms race, right? There is an attempt to take over society and restructure the rules around these very naive syllogisms and the like. And then those of us who are fighting back and blowing up landmines are trying to spread the instinct towards applying nuance and extrapolating carefully and these things. And the question is, which of these two instincts will win? One thing that is maybe going to act in our favor is that the point you make about even if the intersectionalists could have what they wanted, it would be horrible. I don't even think it's horrible. It's unstable. That this conclusion about, you know, the left eating itself, I do think there's a way that doesn't have to be true, but it is often true.
Did you see just this morning about the Guardian in the UK reports that apparently Greta Thunberg has now got it in the neck for being white?
It was a terrible choice on her part.
Can she get nothing right? Greta Thunberg has been criticized by the I think it's extreme reaction, what's it called, got to shut down all the cities now people, and they're all going for her because they're saying she's only got the attention because she's white and people aren't highlighting enough black women who are also in the belief that we're all going to burn to death in the next 48 hours. And it is always eating itself like that, always.
So it's always eating itself because of a basic game theoretic instability, right? These coalitions function when they're pointed in the same direction, and at the point that they have spoils to divide, they turn on each other. And so one of the things that struck me I've been saying that for a long time, but in reading your book, it struck me that the question of trans women, that is people born male who transition to female, competing in women's sports is the first wave of the turning on itself. Because at this point, trans is now backing women against the wall in a way that will destroy the hard-won access to sports that women have enjoyed for the last several decades.
Yeah, as you know, I think the trans one is important because it reveals some of what is actually going on, and because it runs fundamentally against the other groups that it's alleged to have so much in common with. So it obviously runs against women, runs against men as well, but people are less bothered about that. But it runs against women in a very fundamental way, which I try to show. And it also runs against gay, which is one which, I mean, almost nobody has bothered to point out. And it's been presumed that trans is just the next stage in gay, but actually it runs totally counter to it. So that the female tomboy in her teens actually might be told, now, actually, you are a boy and we'll make you one. And I'm very concerned about that. I just, by the way, you started to say something there which led me to remember that, of course, when we talk about how to get out of this, I'm very struck that there are several ways. What I try to do in this book, obviously, is to undo the intersectional thing to the extent that it can be done, to show that how it's woven, to unweave it, and then to redirect people onto, I think, and I don't, I'm not, as you know, I'm not dogmatic about what it is I think they should do, but to redirect people onto better paths. And of the various options open to us, those of us who think that people are wasting their time, it does seem to me that a very important thing must be addressed, which is, okay, let's say we can get lots of people out of this horrible retributive zero-sum game. What ought they to be doing? And I think that we, you know, it's that we can't get out of this unless that is also in the frame. And I'm very concerned about this. And I give some hints in the book of what I think might be an answer. I'm concerned about the opportunity cost in this generation of doing this stuff, of this intense navel gazing, with the idea that if we gaze at it enough, we will sort out the navel. And but. In a way, I think one of the faster ways out of this is to say, why don't people from many disciplines start to talk about what we should be doing instead? You know, because rather like setting up a prize, you know, it's always a good way. If you say, you know, there's $10 million if you solve this problem, you know, it's quite a good way to solve a problem. Is why don't some people just start to work out what actually we would like to be doing? And now it might be, I don't think the purpose of life will simply be longevity, and that if we all live to 150, we've won, because you've still got all the same problems we've always had. But there should be attempts, I think, and it's not like, I'm not saying we need to fabricate them. I just think we need to identify them accurately, or as accurately as we can manage, across many disciplines, and say, wouldn't it be wonderful? You know, because the thing that just amazes me at the moment, I've said this before, but you know, everywhere I go in the world, I travel all the time. I'm in a different country every week, and I speak to so many people from so many different backgrounds and disciplines and all that sort of thing. And one of the greatest things, one of the things that just excites me most and has made me most optimistic in recent years, has been the fact that a young person anywhere in the world who's smart and who has access to the internet is now right at the cusp of the conversations of their time, in a way which never before in human history is possible. You know, one of my great, you know, heroes in the 19th century, Alexander Herzen, those people had to leave Russia and go to Paris and Berlin to pick up the latest critical ideas. And it just took such a long time. And it was such a small class of person that was able to do it. Now we're not in that world. We're in this extraordinary situation where anyone in any country with access to the internet and enough, you know, oomph, can be right at the edge of this. So why would we not be trying to work out what we can do in not just, it's not harnessing, but like unleashing that potential?
So I completely agree with you. And I think the the irony of attacking not only the Enlightenment, but the idea of Enlightenment as if it was a con is, the irony is just gargantuan. And you're right, we are on the verge, almost accidentally, of being able to democratize access to all of the highest quality thinking, and we are fumbling the ball. But you, do you know what course I was teaching at the point that Evergreen blew up?
God, go on.
No, there's no reason you should. I just, you
I've
mentioned
a feeling that'll break my heart. Go on.
Oh, it's going to break your heart, I think. I was teaching something called Hacking Human Nature. So this was a full-time 16-credit course. So I had these students full-time. It was my only job, their only job. And we were studying. Basically, the premise of the course was it's very hard to get the power to change civilization. Nobody knows how to solve that problem. So let's skip it. If we had the power to change civilization, given what we understand about what works and what doesn't work, what would the rules of a good civilization look like? And the core tool was really the trade-offs between competing values. So I should tell you, my students were entirely loyal. The students that you saw were ones I had never met. My students and I were exploring this question, and we were deeply into that exploration at the point that Evergreen boiled over, such that at the very end, I had to hold my evaluation conferences off campus, in my backyard, in fact. So I met with every student after the fiasco had disrupted our ability to meet on campus. And a number of them asked me if I had somehow created the entire catastrophe to illustrate the principles in the program. And, it wasn't like they thought that had happened, but they couldn't shake the idea because it fit so perfectly with what we had been studying.
Very good of you to lay that on. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, right. It was, the ultimate teachable moment, I guess. But anyway, I agree with you completely. What we should be doing is agreeing on the values, as this conversation started there. You and I seem to agree on at least a great many of the values, maybe all of them. And then the question is, well, if you were serious about those values, you're not going to achieve perfection on any of them. But what would an optimal balance look like, and what rules would stabilize it, would achieve it and stabilize it? It's a fair question, and we ought to be having a broad explanation for it, much as you
and
invite.
And then what ought we to be doing? The most enormous gap in our society is the fact that the adults have become distracted or lacking in confidence and have decided, as I say, hand over the keys. Never before have we seen phenomena where, well, at least not for a very long time, where the adults are willing to tell the children what to believe and then say we must listen to the children because only the children know. And for whatever the reasons are, I'm just struck that there is this vacuum, and I wrote about this in my last book a bit more, but it obviously touches on it in this one, but that this vacuum of purpose and meaning, and I know that it's what everybody hopes for in their adolescence in particular, that at some point somebody's going to stand across their lives and say, let me tell you what we're doing here, what you should be doing, and what would be a life that would be worth living. And it was, not everyone ever got it. But to have a society in which no one gets it and no one is expected to get it, and we all just, save up for the next holiday, is not fit for the enormous luck of the situation we find ourselves in.
I think, unfortunately, the reason that we are in this predicament is that very few people actually reach meaningful adulthood, that the adults are incompetent. And part of why they are turning the reins over to the kids is not only do they not know what to do, they wouldn't have the first clue how to figure it out. And maybe it dovetails with what you were saying about anybody anywhere with the access to the internet can be at the forefront of the most important conversations. The small number of people who have some idea what to do next are emerging in the strangest quadrants and participating in these conversations. And that as much as this is a very perilous moment for various reasons, it is also, it's a horse race. It's a hopeful moment in the sense that some curious force is causing people to stand up who otherwise might never be heard from and to participate in really bold discussions about, well, what is true of our situation and what would be a reasonable objective? How do we get there? And maybe I don't think we can paint a well-rendered picture of a good future, but I think we can essentially figure out the path toward a good future. And if those of us who are inclined towards that mission, who have some of the tools necessary to do it, can participate together and not be driven off the map or caricatured into oblivion or whatever it is that might happen, maybe this perilous moment could end well.
Yes, hoping.
Yeah, well, that didn't sound very convincing, Douglas. All right. This has been a marvelous conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing?
I'm sitting in front of one of my bookshelves, as you can probably see. And just as you were talking, there was something that when we were talking earlier, there was something I was reminded of. And let me just go ahead. It's from Arcadia, and it's later on in the play than I remember. But yeah, Hannah and Valentine are talking, and he's talking about relativity and quantum. And he has a great description. He says, it was on my mind. He says at one point about the drip of a tap. He says, we're better at predicting events at the edge of the galaxy or inside the nucleus of an atom than whether it'll rain on Auntie's garden party 3 Sundays from now, because the problem turns out to be different. We can't even predict the next drip from a dripping tap when it gets irregular. Each drip sets up the conditions for the next. The smallest variation blows prediction apart, and the weather is unpredictable the same way will always be unpredictable. When you push the numbers through the computer, you can see it on the screen. The future is disorder. A door like this is cracked open 5 or 6 times since we got up on our hind legs. It's the best possible time to be alive, when almost everything you thought you knew is wrong.
Oh, that's delightful. And it goes to a point I forgot to make at the beginning of the conversation. There is, I think, a single switch that is flipped differently in people who are participating well in this conversation and people who are doing something perhaps more destructive. And it is whether or not there is delight in discovering that you had something wrong, or is there horror? If you delight in discovering that you had something wrong, then the room for growth is tremendous. If you recoil, then you don't grow, and it's a very sad predicament to be in. So I feel that you are one of these people who smiles when you discover you had something a bit off, even if it's embarrassing, and I join you in that, and I hope others will join us as well.
Absolutely. It's been an enormous pleasure, Brett. Thank you.
All right. Be well, Douglas.